Bob is the one that's got a problem with not defining what not habitable.
I don't care how you do it, but if you have terms, they should be either defined or change the term.
Well, let's just eliminate the non-habitable.
You're just a structure, and that could cover both.
Okay, any other questions?
Well, also, we're supposed to suggest changes, write the code.
Yeah, it already says driveway shall be developed within 50 feet of all habitable structures and 150 feet of all non-habitable structures, and we're just redefining structures. Still got that same wording about how far it's got to be. If you can't figure out what's habitable, non-habitable, I guess that you can hash that out personally. So I'm fine with just striking that out. I think that would be my preference. I really don't care about solving.
Okay. So does that sound reasonable to everybody?
We didn't feel like it.
Sounds reasonable to me because the county is fairly stringent about how many habitable structures you can have on a site. You can have a habitable accessory building on a limited basis or a mother-in-law apartment or something like that, but it's not like the zoning allows you to have a bunch of habitable structures scattered around the property. So essentially, in most cases, you only got one habitable structure.
Right, that's not quite right. I mean, a dwelling is defined by a kitchen, but you can have any number of unattached bedrooms, detached bedrooms, that are habitable in the sense that persons can stay in there. They can't cook, but they could shower and have bedrooms. You could have any number.
And have a coffee maker.
So
in that case, you need a driveway within 50 feet.
Yeah.
Well, I would say, 50 feet, right.
You may have to...
500 square feet.
And the problem there is, that's up for saying to some guy.
Because, you know, just a detached bedroom could be 100 square feet.
It should be...
28 acre turnaround.
110.
Hey, any other... comments on this particular? I had one that I'm just looking at it, and that's on the yellow page of 7-24. Under signs, it's under 76060 fire protection service or on-site fire protection plan. And under B, it's requiring a property owner to have a contract for fire service or fire protection on property before anything is developed. And you can't get there from here because the fire Rural Metro bases their contracts on square footage and value, and if you haven't got anything on your property, they can't charge you anything because they're not going to protect anything that's not there.
I ran into that same issue. Like, how can you have fire protection when you don't have anything to protect yet, right? Mm-hmm. Well, Rural Metro will give a contract for $60.
But
And then that seems to satisfy planning.
But the point is that if you're in the Oregon Department of Forestry Fire Protection, you're already paying for protection for the raw land.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And why would you require somebody forcing them to buy something they shouldn't have to have until, I understand it later on. So I guess I have a problem with that section being in there because I think until there's a natural structure there's no reason to protect it because it's already protected. The land is already protected under the Oregon Department of Forestry. In most cases, except for...
They could do something like prior to issuance of a certification of occupancy, which would make more sense.
Well, the question is, does the private fire company service that area, yes or no? If it does, then they're no big deal. If they don't, and I'm assuming Grants Pass or Rural Metro services everything outside of the... fire districts.
They'll service anything as far as I know.
Yeah.
But Harold, this section you're looking at, maybe I'm not, it's all based on as a condition of a permit to develop. So when you're developing, you already have a structure, so that's what they're driving at, isn't it?
Yeah, but you can't, but they want you to have the contract with
first.
The fire department first.
Before they issue the development permit.
And it doesn't
right.
work.
I agree.
I didn't understand.
Yeah.
I see your point.
But I understand that they need to know whether or not there's an ability, if the fire protection folks are servicing the area. Mm-hmm. And the answer to that is yes. Mm-hmm.
But it's
without a contract. It's,
Wouldn't that be just protecting the builder or the homeowner, protecting their start of their construction?
But what are they
going to?
I don't see the value of the county requiring that at this point in time. I mean, that's
I can see the point that you don't want to wait until it's all done and then find out nobody will give them fire coverage. I guess because they say that.
Whose fault? Whose problem is that?
Obviously the homeowner's fault.
Problem.
Why wouldn't they cover it? What would be the factors that would
access?
I mean, all of that would have been handled prior to the development, right? And I mean,
that's part of the development process, isn't it?
But so what about the structure that would cause the, rural metro?
I don't know. If they wanted to cover it, there was a bridge or something, and they came out and looked at it and said,
yeah, we're not going to do that.
We're not going to give you a contract because we're not driving our truck across that bridge.
But all those other things, requirements of Article 10 should apply anyway.
$50,000.
$50,000, still, right. There's a rumor to go up 8,000. Driveway. With the clearance, all is required. But at this point, Bill's right, before you have even a building.
I'm not reading that you have to have a contract before the building begins. I can see how it could be interpreted that way, but I also.
Says that the property cannot be located within a fire protection district, but fire protection service is available from a commercial fire service provider that is listed on the state fire marshal roster. And the owner provides a contract for fire protection to cover the property before the development of any structure begins. Mm-hmm. So he has to have
that's
a contract.
That's you're reading from
B. It's B. In a fire protection district, it's automatically there, I think.
I
think what they're trying to cover is that area that's that doesn't have the fire protection district.
Right.
But almost every area in Josephine County is underneath the Oregon Department of Forestry, except the area between Upper River Road and Lower River Road, sort of the agricultural area, is outside of the Department of Forestry's firefighting protection.
So the Oregon Department of Forestry covers residential zones?
No. They only cover land. They cover
watches. They watch is burned.
Or they'll do whatever they can to keep it from spreading. I mean,
exactly.
They'll protect out around.
Fair lot that's on
that's what this is talking about.
I don't care what the zone is.
State forestry, because I don't pay a tax on my residential zone lots, I don't think.
Yes, you do. You have it. You look in your tax bill and you'll see it.
I think I do on the ones that I have a forest exemption. I think I don't on one out on clover lots.
Mm.
I could be wrong.
Yeah. I know there's some areas that they don't cover.
$40 a year or something like that.
Yeah. So anyway, that's just my...
Well, it does seem a little redundant, because if you are satisfying the criteria of Art 76... Unless you were in some pocket in the county where no fire provider would serve, you, by definition, are ready for fire protection. So to require you before you did anything to pay for a contract doesn't seem like it makes any sense. We had areas in the county where there was no fire protection from either a fire district or a private provider, then that would make sense because you have to indicate that you weren't in one of those avenues. Mm-hmm. You do, where there's just no coverage at all.
And go out down the road. They went up there.
Rural Metro said nope, so they're on the road. Yeah.
For what reason?
Too far. They're not going out.
Go out Galice Road, the other side of Rand. That's too far for Rural Metro to cover. And
the New
England.
Do you know what their cutoff is? What's considered too far?
I'll do whatever they decide.
So what's the option then, Roger?
They do an on-site fire protection plan. ODF is invited in to take a look at kind of what they're doing and kind of gives, it sounds good.
So
they pulled it. We're not going to save the house, so that's great that you have some ability to kind of do something there, but we're just going to come up and make sure it doesn't spread.
C covers everything that A doesn't. It's if you have a property and you're going to build, you put together a fire protection plan. And generally, 9 times out of 10 is ODF and W will come out and help you put that together if you're out in their fire area. And they're more than happy to help you out that way. And I think even Rural Metro will go out quite a ways. But.
No, I'm
But just your suggestion here.
Actually, pick out B and have B. And put C into B because it is an on-site. That it puts the property owner into a position that he can then prepare for a fire protection plan, and he can work with ODF&W or Rural Metro or whoever it may be.
Can I play devil's advocate for a minute?
No. Go ahead.
10 seconds. If Article 76 talks about access and driveways and clearance areas and everything else, and if a fire gets started at your house, Rural Metro will come out, and if you've got a contract, they put it out and they'll charge you. But if you don't have a contract and they put it out, they charge you. So Rural Metro is going to roll on all those anyway, so why are you forcing somebody to have a contract or do these extraordinary fire plans when you have fire services that roll and it's really the property owner's choice or responsibility of whether he has a contract or not? Because to me, this isn't a lot of different from healthcare. You're saying you got to have a contractor, you got to do all these extraordinary things that are over and above, and you go, why? Because Rural Metro is going to come out there, or Inland, or whatever fire company serves that area, and they're going to come take care of it anyway.
You're talking about the ones where they have agreed they would service it if they.
Yeah, if that's the service area. So if you're out on Azalea Drive and your house catches fire, Rural Metro is going to roll, and they'll pull up, and during that time they're going to check to see if they got a contract. But if they see the fire, they're going to start putting it out. And then they've got to deal with the property owner of whether they charge them or don't charge them, so you're getting the same coverage, so it's more an area of financial responsibility than a fire issue here. So it's forcing people to take a contract or do these extraordinary things that are really covered in the rest of Article 76, saying you've got adequate access, you've got adequate clearance, you've got all these factors here. Why are you trying to force something on somebody that may or may not want it?
It may take them 5 years to get the house built.
So it's just... Yeah. It just seems like an over-imposition just because it's easy to administer. I don't see the practical application here of trying to force somebody into doing something. Because I know when I talk to the fire folks, when you're doing fire protection plans, the first thing is, well, we want you to do on-site storage. We want to start talking about sprinklers in the house and all these other things, and you go, but if a fire truck's going to roll up, then why do I have to have all these extra things? And if I do this on my own and put on, personal storage, it may not be compatible with the fire truck that shows up there to be able to hook it on anyway.
So if the fire truck's going to roll, they don't want to do this extraordinary stuff.
The fire truck's going to roll no matter what.
Well, you and Roger, I think, just said that they won't roll way up.
Well, if they're way out in the middle of nowhere, but if you're inside the area that's covered by one of these fire services, you're still going to say, either buy a contract or do these extraordinary things, even though they're going to be covered by equipment that's going to be there no matter what.
Just a second, Lyle. What will happen out in the real rural areas at Grants Pass Rural or Rural Metro or, I don't know, Finland is still in business, if they don't roll on it, ODF&W does. They won't fight the structure fire, but they will water down and protect it from going out any further than it should. They'll never put a drop of water on the structure.
They tell me they'll spray water on the structure. They have to go inside.
But it gets real crazy because I had somebody out in our neck of the woods, this is Jackson County, that we had Fire District 6 on scene. We had Rogue River Fire District 3 rolling, and it was a house on fire. ODFW showed up and says, because it's in a forested area, we're taking jurisdiction over the fighting of this fire, and the house burned down before they got it taken care of, and the guys from the fire district were standing there almost crying, watching that house burn, because ODFW wouldn't let them go in. So there are jurisdictional fights over this stuff when you start playing with these things. But it's just, this stuff is so uneven, and, you know, trying to make everything fit in a nice little box is very difficult to make that happen. Because I know when I go in to get a development permit for somebody today, before Gordy can go get started, I've got to have a well on the property and be able to start pumping water. And you go, if I don't have anything to put out, I may not be ready to put my well in because I'm not sure exactly where things are going. I need to get my permit. And you go into the office, they say, where's your well permit? Dang.
Okay. Lyle Woodcock had his hand up. Lyle, you need to identify who you are.
I heard on the news tonight, Bob, you said about health care, that the judge has ruled it is unconstitutional to force health care onto it.
You can't make somebody buy a private service.
I don't know whether it's the same or not, but it's in a similar package.
Well, my again, the reason I bring it up is this isn't a requirement of state law. This is something that we have, on the local level, made a determination that, not we, but the county has. And the question is that something that we feel should be left in there or should be taken out?
As the subcommittee, we are willing to take this back and come back to you.
Good. I appreciate that.
How about putting it that, as a requirement of the development permit, that the applicant needs to bring a letter showing that the area that they're building in is covered either by a fire district or is an area that is serviced by a private provider.
Isn't that already?
But they don't have either one of those, then they have to go to the ODF.
But isn't that already pretty well known?
The districts.
But the difference is that they don't actually have to pay for a contract at that point, because, like Kit was saying, I mean, sometimes it may take 3-4 years before the house actually gets built. By the time they maybe build a storage building on there to put their lumber in or whatever, and so you're having to pay for a fire prevention contract for a structure that doesn't exist. Whereas at least it would force the homeowner to find out whether they actually are within an area that's covered, and they take their chances that they may have to pay the bill if they don't have a contract and something's on fire. But it would also tell them that, well, you're not in an area that's serviced, you're all the way out in Galice or Winona Road or something like that. Yes. And at that point, that would kick in the provision that you have to have some kind of agreement with ODF because you are not in a serviced area.
Has Rural Metro ever provided a map of the area that they cover to anybody, or
is it just
from word of mouth that, well, they only go out this far? I mean, they've got a station out there, a couple of them out there in Merlin, one right there at Riverbanks and Azalea. And they got another one at Lower River Road. Or Upper River Road.
There's one at
Robertson
Bridge in Azalea.
And Monument
Drive. Anyway, I think it's worthwhile for you folks to take another look at it because I'm not sure that it's.
Okay.
Let me ask Doherty something here. What do you think about this sentence right here? The last sentence in Part A, would that settle some of your concerns? Where the owner has requested to be included in the district and the district agrees in writing to include the property with the development of any structure begins. That's the one I was saying. You could interpret that as saying they will give you a letter before the structure begins, but not, you don't have to sign a contract.
And the same thing with contract fire protection. They pick out a letter indicating that they fall within the area.
Something
so that you don't actually have to start the contract long before you actually have need for the services.
So I'm saying we could put a clause in Part B that's just like Part A, and that would be
great. To
clarify, that's referring to fire districts, and Rural Metro is not a district.
No, I'm saying we could put that section in Part B, where that you have to go and request that Rural Metro or whoever
say that yes, they will cover.
This is an area that we provide service.
Oh, God.
So you have three private providers.
Right.
Whether you,
I
mean, I'm not talking about
rural metro
level of quality or anything. You've got three. So which one of the three do you require? All three? Or you require one?
I think one.
And
I think it would be a good position to have the county request of the fire services the extent of the areas they will cover. Because a fire district, there is a line on a map, because that's an adopted district, and so instead of making the guy go out in every case, say, you know, are you in the district, and you got to go back out to the Illinois Valley and have them sign a paper, you just look at the map and say, there it is, it's in the district, you're fine. If we had a map from each of the fire service providers, say, these are areas we cover, then they're fine. Now, if you're outside of the district, then you go through a formal annexation process to be annexed into the district for, say, the Illinois Valley or Williams or the Applegate. So there it's a formalized process to get that letter under A. Now, that B, we should know where they're covering.
Well, there's a map that was already produced when the county was working on, or this committee was working on putting together the fire district, new district. They came up with a map, they being rural metro, and it showed all of the area that they would cover. So there's already an existing map, and that's the map that ought to be worked from. And that if that's being used, then there wouldn't be a requirement to go out and get a letter from anybody. That's where I was. And I know Grants Pass Rural, or not Grants Pass, but Rural Metro worked real hard, and they defined that whole boundary, and so it's already in place. I'm not sure how it is officially, but I mean, there's my point being is there is a map that already defines the coverage areas. So
I kind of can see where a letter might be necessary in situations. Say somebody's trying to develop a house at the, you know, 5 miles back a canyon, you know, and they're off the grid, and it's still within that map, and you know, the chance of Rural Metro rolling on a fire.
So Rural Metro says I'm not going to come. We're not going to go fight the fire, so the guy can't build the house, even though he may be in a mining.
He might be a mining claim.
He
can go to the on-site fire protection plan C.
It might be a mining claim, or it might be.
I can just see where they might not want to roll on it because it's too dangerous for them to get there.
Well, number one, they can't get there in time to save it in the first place. 90% of the structures out there that are that far out are going to be gone before they ever get in the truck.
Exactly.
is that
we call Rural Metro foundation.
So why don't you folks take another look at it? But like I say, see if there is a map. There should be. You guys might have gotten a map.
I wrote it down.
What's his name? From I can't think of the name now. They're Toby got it put together. Say anything else that we want to take a look at? Anything else in Article 76 that you want to look at this point? We'll continue the discussion on this. So, okay.
Cody put together. I don't know what it encompasses or how old it is.
We'll have a check on that.
Yeah.
Okay, the only other thing is we're not going to take up any more time today on the continuation of the Road Standards Committee report, but I guess what I'd like to do is if there's some chance that by March or March meeting that we could come up with a document to recommend to the commissioners.
I think
you're pretty close.
I think we're pretty close.
On
our Article 76.
Okay.
I think we're pretty close.
And I'm talking about the road standards one. I moved on.
Yeah, well, I'm on the road standards committee, so.
You are? No, I know that. I'm just saying we're not going to have any discussion on that tonight.
No.
But I would hope that maybe by the March meeting we could come up with as a group some idea of the kind of recommendation that we could send that issue on to the commissioners.
Oh, you can do it.
So, not yours. It's not your committee. Road, but
the
road committee.
Oh, no, but they're not here.
I'm the only one that's here.
I know you are. That's why I said this. I'd like to look at it. So at least it gets it on the map.
On the horizon.
Yeah. Okay. Do we have any other reports for subcommittees? Dear Winter.
February.
That'll be February. We're all squared away with that.
Yeah.
Okay. Other matters? Any other matters tonight?
From the public, yeah.
Do we need to vote on what we just presented? Or
no, not at this point. I think the consensus that we had out of this is that you folks are going to go back and come back.
We're going to vote on what we agree on before we get a different mix of people.
Oh, it won't change.
Well, we've got a consensus group here. We don't
need it. Read the minutes. Listen to the tape. Any other matters?
Can I compliment the...
No, they appreciate
good work.
They did.
I'm trying to make it clear and simple.
Yeah.
I got to tell you, it was fun. Pitt and Gene are just so much fun.
But appreciate
you.
Appreciate you folks getting involved in this. This really, really helps us. Next is comments from the public. Anybody from the public have a comment they want to make at this point? Bob Hart.
I've got an issue with the way the code works on non-conforming lots and the issues of adjusting lines with non-conforming lots. And this is one that I worked on out in off of Demery Drive. We've got two lots. One of them is landlocked and one of them is larger. This is an R5 zone. The small one is 1.53 acres. The big one is 5.71 acres. So this is the configuration, the way it sits right now.
So they're both R5?
It's both R5. So zoning's not kind of the issue. What I proposed was to follow the green lines here, which still has one lot above R5, one below, so it's still a non-conforming lot. And the reason I did it on this green line here is because that happens to be the irrigation ditch.
Mm-hmm.
And so the line goes right on the irrigation ditch, splits the two, and everything's fine. This is how I got it approved.
Oh, my God.
Wait, they told me they want to approve both I lots.
And the reason is because the lot in the back, the 1.53 acres, is the non-conforming lot. The one in the front that has actually the structure down over here is the conforming lot. So they said the non-conforming lot has to stay non-conforming and the conforming lot has to stay conforming. You can't swap them. Even though you wind up with one conforming and one non-conforming, they have to stay in their status of conforming or non-conforming when you're done. So this piece in the back got moved over here, and then this one, to maintain the 5 acres, is designed like this. So it just, when you...
What is that based on? Is there actually verbiage in the development code that says that?
Yes. It does.
So where are we talking about? What section are we talking about?
I don't know of anything like that.
Non-conforming lots. Let me try and find it.
13? Is it?
Yeah, 13, 160, 1-60.
1-60. Is Article 13 non-conforming lots used for construction?
Where are you,
Greg? It's in
the white pages.
In the white pages, in Chapter 1, Article 13 on page 1-60.
Okay, what page is that again?
1-60. It's right after the old page, the white version. Yeah. The beginning.
So, I guess...
Okay, it goes back to 13.020, 1.1-59. The size of non-conforming authorized lots or parcels may not be reduced unless the reduction is authorized by this code. See 53.050. I think that's probably where this...
It's replatting. Special review standards is what it's referencing there.
Yeah. This is a property line adjustment is what we were dealing with. But, you know, I just say it. The adjustment...
But the reference is
okay,
3050.
Here it is under section 54.050C, the adjustment of lot lines involving one or more non-conforming lots or parcels shall comply with the following rules. No lot or parcel that is conforming prior to the adjustment shall be made non-conforming after the adjustment.
What section was that, Bob?
This is
54.
54.550C.
5118 is the
page. Yeah, page 5-18.
Okay.
So that one in front that had the house, where we've got the ditch going through it, because it was conforming at 5.71 acres, it had to stay above the 5 acres, so I had to do this to be able to move that thing in the back over here. Now, that parcel in the back, it's the separate lot right now, that's all in the Sand Creek drainage. So that's all just a creek bottom. So you can't build back there anyway. So I tried to move it up front, where we have two buildable parcels. If we've got a house down here, and I go, it makes sense to put the house out here outside of the riparian area. And that's what I wanted to do. And because of that specific section, that if it's conforming prior, that it can't be made non-conforming after, so I wound up with this. And
you
can
just switch the tax lot numbers on.
Give me a big eraser and I'll do that.
So let me ask the question without getting, not being property specific, but I'm assuming that this could occur on different occasions. Is that possible, Roger? I mean,
yeah,
non-conforming. And the reason that...
So you guys are seeing the problem with every planning department in the world, that you can't write a perfect code that's going to work in every unique special situation. So the reality is most of the time, they're just two properties, one's non-conforming, one might be. You can't let the other one go below, or either of the two become smaller than the smallest.
That's because of what this says.
That's
okay,
right.
Now, if there was...
You got a caveat in there that except in a situation where Bob's got something, that it'll work, but that's the problem with the code. You can't write it for every scenario in the world. It is black and white, and there are gray areas, but Bob's right. That's what it says.
Is this a statutory requirement?
No, it's not a statutory requirement, other than you cannot make a non-conforming lot more non-conforming. So that little one, which was 1.53 acres, you can't make that 1.2. That's what statute says. You can't make a non-conforming more non-conforming, but it doesn't say anything about this adjustment thing. And much as, I don't like codes that are too fluid, this is one of the places where the city code says if it will further the intent and purpose of the code to make it more flexible and usable, then it gives the planning director the ability to make the adjustment. And in this case, I can foresee it, other places that some judgment calls are warranted. If you just lock it in with a hard line code, you get things that we wound up with here. It makes no sense whatsoever. So what I told the guy is, go ahead, build your house over here, and then that front part that you really should go with that house, we're just granted an easement, so you have exclusive use of that together with that lot in the back. So, you can cut the system to make it function, but it's just not awful. And you go, why should you have to go through those hoops when there has to be some solutions to it? And that's why I'm saying, at the start of this exercise, let's look at adjusting the whole code. Let's look at the whole darn thing. And not just cherry pick things out that, we need to try and help with the economy today, but I think there needs to be an exercise to relook at the whole darn code to try and get some of these things looked at.
I just have John standing there for the survey. What's that going to cost?
Well, how difficult would it be to add verbiage in there that says, after that sentence, that says, except that the discretion of the planning director when the intent of the this provision is not violated or something, so that somebody could look at this and go, well, obviously we're still ending up with the intent of the law, which is that you don't, you know, move a bunch of things around. But it builds a little flexibility in there, because like Roger says, you start out with something that's kind of a black and white situation, but there, when you come across things like this where there can be improvement, what you need to do is build some flexibility in there.
And that would just be a phrase at the end of the...
Yeah, it's just the question of the semantics to make it so that it applies to that, but it still leaves it up to somebody at the planning department to look at it and go, well, which of these two makes sense? This one makes sense. Is it changing the neighborhood? Is it creating a precedent that's going to be used all over the county? Blah, blah, blah. No, hey, I make the decision. This is okay. Mm-hmm. That's why we have human beings down there instead of just the computer.
Great. If you just eliminated number two,
what page are you on?
On both of them, on the 54,
on 518,
and reach that one too as well.
So 5-18 at the top of page number two, is what you're talking
about. Right, and then the reach that one was 5-15, it's exactly the same language. Just scratch number two. And did they no longer parcels that conform? Or no? Anyway, basically, if in a property line adjustment or a REAP, especially as a property line, because a REAP, this is what this would be, just a property line adjustment, just no lot would be made smaller than
the smallest one,
pre-existing one, period, just leave it, and then let the planning director make a common sense decision.
And that's what the code used to say, but it was changed to the way it says right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Malcolm?
How about on page 5-18? Number one at the top of the page, it says no lotted parcel that conform prior to the adjustment shall be made non-conforming after the adjustment unless a non-conforming lot is simultaneously made conforming.
Oh, yeah, but sometimes you can't. No, it isn't. Because you can't make, if you've got a 5-acre, in an R5 zone, and you have a 5-acre lot and a 2-acre lot, you can't make.
The old way was if you have a 5 and a 3 in a 5-acre zone, you can make 2 4s. And you go, what's the problem?
Yeah.
You know, because you equalize them. But and what it said is you can't make a 6 and a 1.
Right.
So you can't make something more non-conforming, but anything in between is fine. But that all got taken away because of this whole thing of if you've got one conforming and one non-conforming, you can't wind up with two non-conforming parcels. Where in some cases it may make sense, but that's not what the code allows at this point.
So now this is one of the lots still listed for me.
In this case, yeah.
Yeah. With the bow tie.
Yeah, with that ugly.
Oh, even with the green. I thought with the green thing.
Oh, with the green thing, it still worked. Because with the green thing, I came up with.
You still had a conforming and a non-conforming, but you flipped which one was conforming, which one was non-conforming.
Yeah.
So my solution would work in this particular case.
And change the lot number.
Yeah, just get out of the big erasure and change a lot of
them. That would put a simplest solution.
Yeah.
Say, this is now tax lot 200, this is now tax lot 300.
Okay, what we'll do is put it on our agenda on a discussion on non-conforming
uses
for property line adjustments and replats. Sections 53 and Article 54. Article 53 and Article 54. So that'll be on one of our agendas coming up.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, thank you. Trenor.
I got two things. Does that mean I go once and then someone else goes?
No,
or?
You go ahead.
Okay. First thing is, I think I should be called the Rep and Winkle because I didn't realize the county was specifying the amount of rock on a driveway. Did I understand that right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. I mean, I'm in the rock business, but 6 inches of base and 2 inches, that's the old county spec practically.
Mm-hmm.
For regular roads, except for the oil on top.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Just checking to see if it's up under the tree, and here I am. Okay. Second thing is probably 2 months too early, or too early, 2 months early, is on the deer winter range. And maybe it's better to throw it out now so you can be thinking about it when you get to it. Or I can hold it if I, unless I don't show up then. So I'm here now, so. Okay. A few observations, I guess you'd call it. When I was in school, the instructor mentioned that the sovereign owns wildlife, and I believe that was the history was back in the English common law.
Mm-hmm.
The king owned all those critters running around. If that's still the case, that leads a person to some interesting thoughts and conclusions. In effect, if you're pasturing the king's deer on your winter range, wouldn't you be compensated for doing that?
Yes.
I mean, if it was the king's so, and the question in this case then is the king more equal? That's one. And well, then this leads to the next question: is should the concept of critical winter range be a burden on the landowner if he's doing the service of the king? Okay. That's enough of that one. I think I've muddied that one pretty well. And other elements in that whole thing. Again, in school, the comment was that edge effect was the deer's favorite habitat. You know, where the trees and the pucker brush meet, where they can get in and actually reach the food. It's not too tall or it's stuff they can't eat on the ground. And that's where you'll find them feeding. So it would seem to me that if you had more habitations with people's lawns, gardens, etc., pretty good odds you'd have more edge effect. But that's just a comment. Third one is, since I've been in the county, which is several years now, the old days there were deer all over the place. I mean, there were almost too many deer in some kind. But since the cougar situation has gotten out of hand, I don't think most people have that problem anymore with too many deer. They may have too many cougars, but that's another issue. There is a twist on that one, which would be if you encourage deer in the winter range, which is near where the people are, are you encouraging confrontations between people and cougars?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I guess that's about the size of it, except that my understanding of the winter range things is 32 houses for 1,280 acres, which if you divide it comes out 40 acres per house. Maybe that's mm-hmm. Proper.
Yeah. 2 square miles and 40 acres.
Yeah. Anyway. That's enough for one night.
Well, in answer to your first comment about charging the state for the grazing of their animals, we did approach that in 1984-85, and we felt that the property owner should be compensated by the state for allowing their animals to be running wild on private property when they had enough of federal and state lands, and we didn't really get anywhere with that. But it was an attempt. And the other interesting part that I run into is under the Fire 76, and I haven't, I was trying to find it, is under the vegetation management, there's a conflict, because under the requirement of the Senate Bill 360, as a property owner, you're required to clear your vegetation or the vegetation on your land up a certain height. Well, the vegetation that's being removed is the same vegetation that is needed by the wildlife, especially the deer, and therefore they are not able to get the vegetation they're needed for that, because the other rule says you got to remove it, or if you don't remove it, you're going to be liable. And so there's some conflict in that, and I don't, it's never been resolved yet.
Well, I think I have a solution. So,
so that's under work. Okay. We're still going to go public. Lyle Woodcock.
I'd like to tell you a story that happened when they started killing the fawns, the does. The does in the summer, in summertime led their fawns in and raised them in our fields and so forth. So when the mother disappeared, well, they stayed in the fields. But you'd see them in the wintertime when the frost and stuff would get on the grass, they'd have runs on the back legs. And pretty soon they'd find a pile over there. I plowed 19 fawns under one spring. That's the mothers would take them back into the woods and get hard browsing versus grass that had been frosted. And that's a terrible shame. But now you got the cougars out there waiting for them to come to them.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Grace?
I just wanted to comment on your mind. Is that, you know, really, from what, some a couple of the articles that we passed out to you guys, and also my brother-in-law, who's a forester, we're talking, he was saying the same thing, that with the environmentalists pretty much shutting down the forest and clear-cutting, that, which is the preferred habitat, which is your other term for that I didn't understand, about open space.
Edge effect.
Yeah. Edge effect. Okay, I was running all together. Didn't make sense. Anyways, of course, they don't have the grazing or the browsing available up now in the forest, so they're moving down to closer to residential areas, and the cougars are following, which increases the contact between the cougars and people,
okay,
which is, you know, what we're having. Mm-hmm. Have. Yeah. There is a link.
Definitely. You want to read a very eye-opening book on that. There's a book called The Beast in the Garden, mm-hmm, and it's about Colorado Springs, or Boulder, or Colorado Springs. Anyway, the suburbs there where the deer were doing that and moving down, and people were feeding the deer and actually attracting the deer.
Yeah.
And the cougars naturally started calling them down, and the Fish and Wildlife people were saying, you guys quit doing this. You were creating a smorgasbord down here. They're eating the deer for lunch and your poodle for dessert. But there were a lot of people that, you know, thought they were living in Disneyland or something and resisted that until finally, after it was a couple of years of very serious controversy over people drawing up sides. And then one day, this high school kid who was at a high school like Hidden Valley or North Valley was jogging on a trail, and he became the cougar's lunch, and all of a sudden it changed the discussion considerably. But it's a real interesting book about that whole concept of the interface between the wildlife and the suburbs and people not respecting that these are wild animals. And so if you see it, it's called The Beast in the Garden. It's a really good book.
Okay, any other comments?
I got one last one. Bob? It's more a request for support out of the Land Use Committee. I'm working with a number of people and trying to get something worked out with ODOT and the county for major facilities and how to deal with those on a proportional basis. And how this came up was the Merlin Interchange does not meet mobility standards for ODOT. It just doesn't meet it. So any project that pushes traffic into that intersection can be denied because it does not have satisfactory transportation facilities. If you've got a small project, you can't stand the cost of fixing it. Because the fix, just for an interim fix, is about $450,000. And if you're doing a partition or you're trying to put in a industrial or commercial business, are you going to eat that overhead? But the problem is that the way it stands is the first one in to be able to prove the point has to fix the facility. And we're not doing local improvement districts or advanced financing districts. And with the Dolan decision, you can't
require somebody to do more than what their actual impact is. The county policy has been, is if you want to volunteer to do that additional work, then your project can go forward. But if the county has to require it as a part of your project, they're just going to deny it, because if they require it, then it's a taking. And it's contrary to federal or constitutional issues. What we don't have in place is a way to do a proportional share. If some people call in systems development charges or some other kind of methodology, ODOT says a bank account can be set up and people can contribute toward it, to where they look at it as, if you have a program in place that will fix the facility, they're looking at the long-term solution and everything's fine. But say if you came in with a partition, you're going to put two more cars in the interchange, they're going to say no and you're denied. It would have, if the economy would have been fine, Paradise Ranch would have had those signals in place right now, but they're delayed by about 3 years from what their original purpose was. So in these next few years, it's hell on trying to get a project through unless we get some support of, you know, even a letter from the committee here for the Board of County Commissioners saying, we would like you to look at trying to find solutions for proportional shares to fix big facilities. So that's kind of a request, an ask for some support, and I don't know if it's a subcommittee out of here, but I've got a working group that I'm working with, SoReady, and I'm talking with a couple of private developers that were trying to figure out something to do here to solve the problem. It, right now, it can't be solved. The county's just going to deny things.
Well, part of it seems to me, and this has been a few years ago, under the REVAC process, which is the Rogue Valley Area Commission on Transportation, and that's made up of Jackson and Josephine County and the jurisdictions, that interchange at one time was a high priority by the City of Grants Pass and Josephine County, and I don't know where it is now.
It's not on the six-year SNP plan, so it's...
So somebody is... So I guess the point is that there should be a move or a discussion with the board to reactivate and get that on there, because it's Josephine County is the one that's been losing the money. I mean, they've done the north or the south interchange. They're doing a whole lot of stuff for Highway 62 in Jackson County, and I guess the best thing would be to find out where that project could be or should be in the REVAC process, so that the funding could be put in someplace. I know that
we talked with ODOT as trying to get it in the STIP plan, the six-year plan, and it's, unless there's some kind of in-kind contribution, state says, no, sorry. So there needs to be some dialogues. I'm working with the planner out of the region office in Roseburg, and they've been very helpful in wanting to talk about this, but trying to build enough support to say we need to get this fixed.
But if the county brings that project into the REVAC meeting, mm-hmm. and if the city and the county agree, and they can get the other jurisdictions in Jackson to agree, they can put that in there without ODOT saying, no, we won't do that, because ODOT has to respond to the projects that REVAC puts into place. So we probably need to have a discussion. And I don't know if Rob sits on that as a technical person or not. City person... I don't know who was there. He's not on the city council anymore. He just doesn't, he'll be off. So we'll have to find out. But we can't take an action on it today. But no. Let me do some digging on that.
Well, two Chris. Things, since I live there out there, since they put the left turn signals there, it really made things go much smoother. So I didn't realize it was still a problem. But ODOT just got denied by Jackson County that big old welcome center. South of Ashland?
Ashland.
Which was going to be a huge amount of money.
Well, they got denied by Luba. Luba turned them down. Or yeah. Luba reversed the decision, I think, didn't they?
Wait.
Yeah, Luba shot it down.
See, the county approved it, then you were...
The county wanted it.
Well, yeah, but that's free money. I mean, that's...
The problem with that is that the state of Oregon doesn't put in another rest area. They owe the federal government $10 million.
Oh.
Because they tore out the other rest area interchange, which most people don't realize. That was federal money, and they should not have poured it out.
Mm.
And so when they tore it out, all of a sudden somebody says, wait a minute. And so that's been the behind-the-scenes push right now of why they need that new rest area, because if they don't get something in place, they're going to pay the federal government $10 million.
They need a big welcome center.
And the city of Ashland, I think, and the residents were the ones that appealed that.
Yeah.
I think that...
some go back and do it and get approved. It was a water issue. They didn't take a goals exception, and they should have.
Yeah.
They felt because they were the state, they didn't have to.
Yeah.
So they got popped out.
Yeah.
But they'll fix it and they'll get it approved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going to take, but I can't remember the time frame. There's a time frame that the state has to do something. Maybe as long as it's in the mix, they're okay. But
Bob, I think you said that the developer could voluntarily pay a share of the cost of that.
A developer can do the whole project.
Well, sure, but...
He can voluntarily do that.
No, can they voluntarily do a part of it? Isn't that what happened with Pioneer Meadows? Did they say, okay, we are paying based on how many cars are in general?
We talked about that as a condition of approval, but Pioneer Meadows got appealed and later in 49, the whole thing fell apart. The Planning Commission did it, and the developer said that's fine, but it was appealed by a group in. As part of the appeal, all of them fell apart.
Part of the appeal was based on that road?
On all kinds of things.
Yeah.
That was just one of the factors.
That seemed like a fair way to do it. Like, okay, we're generating 20 cars a day, we'll pay $100 with the cost of the thing.
Absolutely. It makes a lot of sense, but that's not the way it's working.
You've got to do it with SDC.
Yeah.
That's the problem. You can't just set up an account and run voluntarily, because we've had this discussion with Steve Rich. So... You can get there with SDCs, but nobody wants SDCs.
Well, before anybody starts talking with SDCs, I invite you to come and sit on the other committee that I'm on right now, which is the city trying to figure out how we were going to fix the transportation SDC in the city, which has become a monster that grew and killed projects and is way unfair.
Mm-hmm.
So
this is not a simple fix. You know, it's complex, but it takes some energy being put into it to fix it. You can't just say, I don't want to deal with that, because you're going to have to deal with that one way or another. There's, I know one of the big things that when Mark, I'm trying to remember his last name, that worked for the county, he had a project for the North Valley Industrial Park that could have brought 350 jobs in. But by the time everything got figured out what to do, that thing went someplace else. Because it's too long to figure out solutions. So we've got to fix solutions now in advance of the projects instead of when they're at our door. And we say, yeah, we have a fix for you 2 years from now. And they go, there's other places that I can put my business.
Well, I say it was a high priority for the county to have that interchange fixed with state monies, and somewhere in the years it's somehow gone to the bottom or dropped off of it. And I think if the county asserts itself in the city, they can probably push that back onto a priority of that committee, onto REBAC, which then forces ODOT to have to deal with it. ODOT supposedly is supposed to work with the committee, the REVAC group, on dealing with it. So.
Is the REVAC committee still extant?
Huh?
Is it still there?
Yeah. It's a statutory requirement now. It's the only body that can report to or request things from the Oregon Department of Transportation Commission.
Uh-huh.
Cities and counties can't go to them directly anymore and deal with them. They have to go through this REVAC group. So it's just a process.
For some reason the county didn't do that?
No. I'd say I'm not sure how active or inactive they've been over the last couple, 3 or 4 years, because it's not been to their benefit as far as receiving any funding. They just sort of got overwhelmed. So.
Unless your name's Jackson County. Huh? Unless your name's Jackie.
Jackie Kelly. Kelly, yeah. So anyway, I think I'll dig into that and get some more information and see what can happen. Anything else before this committee? If not, we'll see you on January 10th, and Merry Christmas. And thank you, people, for your participation.